Federal pick in about 50 minutes from right now. You want to take a stab at who it's going to be, Lisa?
Wow. You know, for us nerds, this is a big day. But you know what? I honestly have no idea who it could be because if it were me choosing, I would pick someone who was maybe not in the spotlight, who was kind of a safe, steady presence, and who wasn't going to be a distraction. So if they're looking in that realm, it's not going to be anyone flashy. Of course, I hear Perry Bellegarde's name being put around quite a bit, who is, of course, the outgoing national chief for the Assembly of First Nations. You know, I don't think it's going to be him. But
what do you think? There's another rumor, Susan Aglukkaq, the Inuit folk musician. She would kind of, although she's got, you know, presence, people know her, but she doesn't have that same kind of potential, you know, people pushing back kind of scenario, no?
You know, that's true. I hadn't heard her name, but she's, you know, she's never been controversial.
Yeah.
She's, you know, a prominent Canadian artist. You know, like, maybe.
Mr. Holsky.
But being the representative of the Queen, though, unless there's something that would perhaps change the entire role of the Governor General, perhaps, I mean, maybe change the title, change the position. It's interesting to me that the backdrop for this is happening at the Canadian Museum of History, the former Museum of Civilization in Gatineau. Maybe
that might be another indication.
Maybe
they're tipping their hand of Indigenous roots, right?
Of something different.
Yeah.
Maybe a change to the position going forward. It's funny to me because this was billed in the itinerary that was released last night as an important announcement. And normally when you hear that an important announcement is going to be made directly from a federal official, it's something that's not important. So surprise, surprise.
Yeah.
It's something that actually is important happening at 10 o'clock this morning. Maybe it's a visible minority. Maybe it's somebody from Quebec. Maybe it's a Montreal Canadian. I mean, if Justin Trudeau's a Habs fan, right? Maybe it's Georges Laroque. Maybe Georges Laroque is the new Governor General. Yeah. I don't know. It could be anybody.
Well, somebody said Dominique Leblanc, of course, son of Romeo Leblanc, family friend, cabinet minister now, but I don't think that would be appropriate choice given where we are in this country. Lisa?
Well, not only not appropriate, I mean, the prime minister would be skewered for it. So, no, and I think Dominique Leblanc has still a very important job to do in the House of Commons in his current role as we're about to, you know, speculatively go into another election. So I don't think it will see another LeBlanc in the Governor General's residence.
Has Jim Watson been tweeting this morning, Chris?
I haven't seen any tweets.
I don't know. I just throw that out there. He checks a different kind of box. But and it is a liberal after all. We'll have to watch and see. That, of course, we'll take it live for you coming up in about 50 minutes. All right, over to the UK now, where the PM, Boris Johnson, says that they must learn to live with the virus. Basically, as of the 19th, those measures in place, the masking, the social distancing, will be lifted. And the onus is now on the person and not the state. Is it time to look at personal responsibility as we move closer and closer? We're number one in the world when it comes to rolling out first doses. You're looking at me like I'm crazy.
Well, this has been about personal responsibility from the get-go, and it's funny hearing a world leader say something like this. I know the rules are in place where you have people getting fined for violations, but at the start, when this all began, the pandemic started in March of 2020, people were asked to do something. They were asked to stay physically distant from other people, and it was when they didn't that more and more fines were being added and more regulations were on top of it. And to hear the complete full circle to personal responsibility again, that's the way that it has been from the start. And all that we proved over and over again collectively as a society is when it was left just up to us without those rules in place, we failed. It's like we failed to show personal responsibility. Maybe not all of us, but at least a significant enough group to ruin it for everybody
else.
Yeah. And now you hope that vaccines are enough to offset that.
Too soon, Lisa, or do you like that idea?
Well, you know, I was looking at the Boris Johnson's comments today, and, you know, they're in the middle of a COVID outbreak.
Yeah.
And at the same time, he was saying that they're going to lift all restrictions. He was also saying that we could start seeing up to 50,000 new cases a day. It's like he's given up.
Yeah, but the metrics have changed, right? They no longer look at number of cases. They look at hospitalizations, ICU admissions. And I say it's time we shift the focus from one metric to the other as well, because we would win that battle and we would see a lot of openings, especially here in Ottawa, if that were the case.
But I don't think you go, it's not binary, right? It's not either or. I think the way we're doing it, you know, to give some credit to Doug Ford, who has made quite a few mistakes in the last few months, but he's actually being smart and cautious about the reopening.
Yeah.
Because we all have to remember, like, I'm double vaxxed, and I'll tell you, it feels like, you know, I'm a superhero at this point, but my grandson can't get vaccinated. So we have an entire cohort of people, 12 and under, who haven't chosen not to get vaccinated. They can't be vaccinated. So we still have to be careful. We have to protect the people who can't be vaccinated. So I'm all for this kind of cautious approach.
How did your second vaccine go? Do you have any side effects?
Honestly, so I'm AstraZeneca-Moderna combo.
Yeah.
No side effects.
Mr. Holsky, what are we, 27 hours now you're telling
me? I'm on day two of my second dose hangover right now. Graham Richardson, after he was leaving your show yesterday when he did his one talk spot, like, I asked him how it went for him, and he said roughly about 27 hours in, he started to develop chills. And as fate would have it, 27 hours in for me yesterday, I developed a light fever. But it didn't get much worse than that.
That was the Habs game. Until the overtime, and then suddenly it went away.
I slept through the whole thing last night because I felt awful and went, okay, well, I'm going to bed. And I had enough muscle aches that it kept me awake practically for most of the night. So, like, part of it is the fact that I feel tired. But now here we are now. It's 9 o'clock in the morning. It's less than 48 hours. And outside of fatigue caused by not sleeping much, I feel fine.
Did you mix your cocktails, or did you go mRNA on both?
I was Moderna for both doses.
Okay. Yeah. I mixed AstraZeneca and Pfizer. I slept for 12 hours after. That's all. It was the only side effect. It might be the hours at work. I don't know. But it really worked. And I see a lot of people who suffer afterwards. I was one of the lucky ones, especially when you mix, right? They warn you. They warn you it's going to be tough. All right, let's talk about the next issue. And this is something that I wonder is going to stick around as we head into an election campaign. After all, he shaved his beard. He's about to name the governor general. The writ's going to drop in August, they say. However, Bob Fyfe, let's give him credit, The Globe, talking about the fact that Data Sciences, which is a Montreal-based company, that just happens to be owned by a longtime friend and childhood friend of the prime minister, Tom Pitfield, has been given a lot of money, a lot of tax dollars, we're talking millions here, to do some work when it comes to digital strategy during the elections. Oh, and by the way, his wife, Anna Ganey, she was Liberal Party president from 2014 to 2018. Now, the optics stink here, but every party, you know, will give contracts to their friends sometimes. Is this one a conflict of interest? Or if the work is done, therefore, they were potentially, if they did tender, the best for the job. Lisa, you want to start that one?
Yeah, great. Thanks. honestly, like, here we are. The House has risen. We're all waiting for an election to come. I don't think it's going to be August, but I think it'll be soon thereafter. And we are in official silly season. This is what's happening here. You know, people are trying to create stories because, you know, the summer can be boring for us political hacks. You know, but on this one, you know, every party has this. You know, I left the Hill in 2010. I had already been trained on Liberalist using the software. Hmm. You know, so this has been around longer than Justin Trudeau has been leader of the Liberal Party of Canada. You know, we all remember, but way back, I think, what was it, probably around 2012, we had the robocall scandal with the Conservative Party of Canada. Because the reality was the Conservative Party was actually the best at data management with voter intention and information. So, you know, this isn't a story. And if I were a political party leader and I needed to have software in place that was going to hold confidential information, sensitive information, I'm certainly not going to go to you know, someone who works for the Conservative Party of Canada or the New Democratic Party. I would pick someone who I would trust to have my best interests at heart.
But I think the question here is, these aren't Liberal funds, right? This is tax dollars at work, is it not? This isn't party funds.
But they're not doing political work. they're doing constituency work, some of which I've also done that. And I had to do it back in the olden days where we had literal, you know, actual cardboard file folders in front of us, and we would just slide pieces of paper in them. And that was our data management system for constituency work. And you're dealing with really important files. So to be able to have MPs' offices be able to use software that allows them to better manage constituency casework, I don't see a problem with that.
Any conflict for you, Holsky?
I don't think this is going to end up registering as a blip. Honestly, I'll be surprised if we don't hear about a similar story or a similar report where some of the names have changed as we approach the election. Like, it'll happen again.
Well, if you look at when governments are in power, and again, if there's the process that is normal, and Lisa said it best, you go with, I guess, who you think is best for the job, and there's always going to be potential conflicts. The difference, someone said, well, this is like the Wii scandal over again. And I said, well, the difference with that is that the Wii thing never went through, and it stunk badly, but it didn't register with the voters after a few weeks, other than the conservative voters, it seems. But this one, I'm wondering if this one is going to get any play, and both of you say no.
I don't think so. I don't think you're going to see this influence the election.
Okay. Let's go. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I was going to say, it's an Ottawa bubble story, right? Like, the only people who read this stuff are us.
Yeah.
Normal people have way bigger problems to deal with. They're worried about healthcare. They're worried about, you know, their jobs and the economy and all those other things that people who are struggling to get ahead are worrying about. They're not worrying about this.
Do you think the ballot box question will be how we did in terms of the vaccination and the rollout, and that ultimately the two-dose summer will lead to a win for Trudeau again? Does it come down to that simple?
Well, I think part of it is the fact that the Conservative Party of Canada has cratered. You know, they picked a leader that is not popular. And I'll give them some props here. It can't be easy to be the official opposition during a global pandemic.
Exactly.
You know, so they've had a hard job here. But to be fair, to give credit to Justin Trudeau's Liberal Party, they put in place very quickly a lot of safety nets that helped those very same families that don't care about data sciences to keep food on the table and a roof over their head, and to make sure that they were provided for and okay during the pandemic. So I think most people remember that. Even people who don't traditionally vote Liberal, they know who was putting in place the policies that were helping them get through this. And to be fair, you know, on the vaccine procurement, I know there were a lot of detractors, and you saw them all the time on Twitter, but of course elections are not won or lost on Twitter. And the reality is, those of us who were paying attention to the numbers and the months that the vaccines were supposed to be coming in, there was a bunch of people quite a while ago who said that by the end of July, we could potentially all have appointments for second doses.
Yeah.
So, right, they under-promised, over-delivered on vaccine procurement, and the provinces got it together and kicked it into high gear and made sure that they got those needles in arms. I think all those governments that were able to do that are potentially going to do well in the next election.
So, Doug Ford, you think we'll get the success provincially that Trudeau is getting federally?
Well, yeah, because Doug Ford also has the same benefit.
Yeah.
He doesn't have any strong opposition to him.
Is that the ballot box question, in your opinion, Holsky?
I don't think it's going to be just vaccines. I think that Indigenous relations are going to end up playing a big role over the course of this federal election. Somebody needs to have a plan, and they will be judged on that.
Huh, Lisa?
I hope so.
Yeah, I know.
You know, right? I mean, we now have non-Indigenous people can no longer say, "I didn't know."
Yeah.
You can't look away from this anymore. Yeah, this has all been front and center. We've now seen it, and it's going to keep happening. Yeah, there are dozens and dozens of these so-called schools that still have to be looked at with the radar equipment to see if they can find these stolen children. So this is going to be going on for a number of years. And I'm hopeful, you know, on July 1st, on Canada Day, we didn't celebrate, and we went to a very small town in Ontario. My little family and I, we all wore orange shirts, and I was a little nervous. I was wondering what kind of reaction we were going to get. And I was very surprised to see so many other families doing the exact same thing. So I think, you know, to Chris's point, if Canadians stay engaged on these issues, I think absolutely every party that's running for in the election has to have a really effective policy for the advancement of reconciliation and Indigenous peoples, no question.
I think this time the younger generations are starting to get it because, to your point about families, they're having this discussion. And the kids, I don't know if you saw the story on CTV News last night, a kid walking across, I mean, I think it's like 1,000 kilometers, raising money for the Indigenous community. I'm out reaching out to a mom whose daughter opened a lemonade stand and 7 years old, and all money collected is going to the Indigenous community because she told her daughter about what these families went through in our lifetime, sadly. And I'm seeing that shift. I'm seeing that, and it's going to come down to the younger generations and I guess getting it right. And that may also reflect the orange versus the red and white this year. I think it might have been a generational thing as well. All right, we can take a quick break up next. 4-day work week. You like it? Well, there was a pilot project. I'll tell you why. It was an overwhelming success. That's next. Lisa Kirby, Chris Holsky, and Leslie Roberts, the Big Five, right after this.
Five stories.
We're counting them down. Joining me, as always, Chris Holsky from the newsroom and Lisa Kirby, Blackbird Strategy CEO. All right, let's talk about Iceland, specifically a project that a lot of people are looking and pointing to and saying, hey, I want to try this. It's a 4-day work week pilot. They describe it as an overwhelming success. They work fewer hours, and not only happier, they are more productive at their jobs. This is according to this pilot project. Between 2015 and 2019, the Reykjavik City Council worked with the federal government with trade unions to test the pros and cons of the 4-day work week. 2,500 people, more than 1% of the country's workforce, worked 35 and 36 hours a week as opposed to the standard 40 with no reduction in pay. Now, it sounds like a good idea. You put in a few extra hours every day and ultimately, potentially, you end up with the same pay. What's not to love about this, Lisa?
Well, I think it's great. And I think what we're going to see here in Canada, too, you know, employers, including myself, trying to come up with, you know, a new normal that was better than the old normal. So already, you know, with my staff, we already try to wrap up early on Fridays so everyone can get a head start on the weekend. And, you know, I try to make sure we don't work past 5 o'clock every day. And, you know, giving them flex time too. I just think it's a great idea to move away from the traditional Monday to Friday, 9 to 5.
On a side note, are you hiring? Asking for a friend. Holsky, what do you think
We could trade jobs for a while.
I don't think we can only work 4 days in our business.
It's like, come on, like 4 days a week. It's just like, am I going to say no to that? Absolutely not. One thing I do know, though, is working mornings, especially in our industry, it's like you need a long weekend, like once a month, roughly, because you need that sort of recharge time. And if we had a recharge day, an extra recharge day every single week, I don't care if I'm working 10 hours a day, it would really help.
Yeah. Before we go, did you watch the game last night, the Habs?
I slept through the whole thing.
Maybe you should just sleep through the rest of the game.
It's like maybe I'll sleep through the next game. I just want to watch a game six. That's it. I just want to see game six on Friday night so that I can enjoy that one. And then who knows what could happen.
So you heard the Tampa mayor, right, where she was saying, you know what, we'd really like to win at home, so maybe give this game to the Habs. What was she thinking?
Yeah, that's bulletin board material. Yeah. So game five tomorrow night in Tampa. I'll probably sleep through it. But hopefully.
What are the chances?
So what the chances?
Yeah, if we go into it overtime, I think we're good. I'm lobbying for a fourth period for next season.
I will always say this. If you are up 3-1 and you have a chance to win at home and you don't, you're in trouble. If Tampa doesn't win game five and Montreal ends up narrowing the series to 3-2, then Tampa's in trouble.
All right, there you have it. Mr. Holsey going back into the newsroom. Lisa, what do you think? Would you watch? Are you a Habs fan?
We're talking about hockey. Right?
Yeah, we are. Yeah, Canada's team, Lisa.
Oh, apparently.
Yeah.
It was all over Twitter, so all I can say is happy that a Canadian team won.
Yeah.
That's great. No, didn't watch.
Yeah, and I'm being facetious here. Growing up in Montreal and being disappointed so many times and, I don't know, spending 15 years in Toronto and watching Leaf Nation and the dedication they have through thick and thin and mostly thin. This is a little bit of a break for as you say, Canada. And at this point, just the fact that they were able to win that one game, that was huge, I think, if nothing else, for boosting morale. I don't know. You know Aislinn, the cartoonist from the Montreal Gazette? He did. There are a lot of haters on Twitter towards the Habs, and I know many of them texting me because they're either Sens fans or they're Leafs fans. He put up what looked like a beaten and battered hockey glove with the Habs logo on it, and it was all kind of, you know, bent over, except the middle finger was sticking straight up for the haters. Lisa Kirby, always good to have you on. Thanks for your time this morning.
You're very welcome. Have a great day, guys.
You too. 9:31. Let's go to the newsroom and bring in Chris with the headlines. News Talk 580 CFR.
You're listening to Ottawa at Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580 CFRA.
All right, if you just are joining us, we have a new Governor General this hour. Mary Simon, the 30th Governor General of Canada. She's an Inuk leader, former Canadian diplomat, and she had to face a number of tough questions from reporters. She doesn't speak French. She's bilingual, but she speaks her native tongue, Inuktitut, and as well as English. She says she was denied the right to learn French at the federal day schools up in the northern part of Quebec. The Prime Minister was asked about vetting process. She was asked about, have they talked about dropping the writ for the election? And also the issue of the conflict potentially here of being Indigenous and representing the Queen, of course, as head of state in Canada. Let's bring in journalist, columnist with the Washington Post. He's based here in Ottawa and also author of Too Dumb for Democracy, David Moskrop. David, good morning, sir.
Good morning.
I was thinking as we were listening to her, this is probably the only time as Governor General she'll actually have to face reporters' questions. Am I wrong?
I suspect.
Yeah.
She'll be in front of them again. In fact, I'd be very curious to see how she handles that given the last Governor General. I would suspect that we'll see more of her. And in fact, you'll note as well that the Chief Justice has also started a process of speaking to reporters and having an annual press conference, which
okay.
I think has been good for the court. So
yeah.
I do think there's a move in this country to make sure that officials are in front of the cameras and reporters a bit more. But of course, you do want a little bit of distance. And, I suspect we'll get a bit of a balance.
How did she do today?
Well, I think remarkably well for someone who has just taken on this job at an extraordinarily difficult time in the aftermath of losing a governor general through scandal. And, of course, the first question was about the election.
Yeah.
because, of course, it was. We can't help ourselves. Which she handled quite well by saying, well, we didn't talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Although she looked down at her notes, so clearly she'd been briefed, as you would be.
And had prepared, right?
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of her answers were read. And,
yeah.
You know, to be honest, I don't typically have a problem with that. You know, I kind of like the idea that folks are preparing and
yeah.
thinking about this ahead of time, especially if they've just taken the job. You know, I mean, again, we often forget this on our side of things, that empathy is really important. As much as we need to hold people to account and get to the truth, we throw these human beings into extraordinary positions, and then we expect them off the starting line to be flawless. It takes a little bit of time to get your legs.
You know, empathy is a really good way to describe her presence right there, and why wouldn't she be, given where she comes from? And I think that it's hard, and it's hard to take. She's not Julie Payette. She is empathetic. She has good goals. She admitted she didn't speak French because she was denied the opportunity. Interesting choice of words. Denied the opportunity at the federal day school. But I leave it to my colleagues in Quebec, you know, make it their first question. Is it okay that they don't speak French? And she's promising to learn. Were you surprised that question was the first one on the Francophone side?
I'm not surprised it was.
Does it matter?
Journalists would ask that question.
Does
and
it
I think
matter?
I think it's a good question.
Yeah.
I mean, I certainly think it needs to be asked. And it's not just Quebec. I mean, as a colleague of mine pointed out on Twitter, there
yes.
are quite a few French-speaking folks outside of Quebec, not just in Ontario.
Yeah.
There's plenty in Ontario, in New Brunswick, obviously, in the West. And so it is a national issue. And so I do think it's appropriate that the Governor General speak French. She's going to learn. And what we're going to end up with is a trilingual Governor General who speaks English, French, and her indigenous language, Inuktitut. And I think that's fantastic, and I think we should welcome that. We should give her a little bit of space and time to learn,
yeah.
But I do think it's appropriate for her.
Perhaps the translators can go back to school and learn it as well, the language area.
Well, exactly. Maybe we should be talking more and more about why we're not speaking indigenous languages.
And why there was no one translating it, absolutely. Yeah. And that's sort of a statement of where we stand as a country as well. The Balancing Act, because she's indigenous and representing the Crown in Canada, some say that could be awkward. She handled that question, I thought, quite well, as being the bridge.
Me too, and by not saying a ton as well, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, basically, you know, that saying that there's time to grow into this job and trying to think about it. And, you know, obviously for the government and for the Prime Minister, there's a lot of symbolic power and value that they're pursuing by saying that this is about reconciliation, and this is, you know, part of bringing communities back together and healing. I certainly will leave it to Indigenous communities and nations to decide for themselves if this is enough. And obviously for the Governor General, designate herself to decide if it's enough. This is one of those moments where it's not going to be for settler Canadians to decide if it's a good fit and if it's the right way. It's going to be for Indigenous peoples. From watching the Indigenous colleagues and friends that I know, I think there's a lot of people struggling with it who want to see it work, but who are worried that a colonial institution won't be able to respond properly. But I'm certainly going to watch to see if there are ways in which it can. I remember years ago talking to an Indigenous person who worked for the City of Vancouver for an interview, and she said to me, my goal is to indigenize the City of Vancouver and all that it does. And I could imagine a world in which Indigenous people in positions of power in this country indigenize elements of the state and make them work. So that's something I'll be watching for quite closely.
The timing, I mean, let's face it, if it were 6 months ago, her name would probably not make the short list, I'm guessing. And that is perhaps an indication of how we are shifting as a country and where we go from here. I mean, there's so many positives in this today.
I wonder, you know, I mean, this is certainly in, you know, reconciliation has been on the agenda for a long time. It's in our consciousness in a way that it hasn't been so acutely present for some time for all of us. For some people, it has been for a very, very long time,
yeah.
Right? I mean, this is the thing, is that a lot of things that we miss are absolutely observed by others. So I think it's on the agenda in a big way. And that opens up an opportunity, because there's a discourse shift and a consciousness shift happening in this country. What we're paying attention to, what we're saying, what we're seeing, and the opportunities for real change that, like, positive, but also material and power shift change that opens up in these moments. And I think this appointment is indicative of that. And I do think that's powerful, because here's the thing, things have changed and we're open to things that we weren't open to before.
Yeah.
And that's when big things happen.
And it's a pretty big thing today. David, appreciate your insights. Thank you, sir.
My pleasure always. Thank you.
David Mossgrop, based here in Ottawa, columnist for The Washington Post, and his book is Too Dumb for Democracy. 1049. Lisa McLeod, MPP, Minister of Tourism, and so much more, joining us with an announcement specifically to tourism in Ottawa. Next, News Talk 580, CFRA.
580, CFRA. Share your opinion now. Text us at 580-580. Please include your name and where you're texting from.
Yesterday was the busiest day at the Ottawa airport since way back at the beginning of the pandemic. Things are slowly but surely coming back, and hopefully the tourists as well. In the meantime, it's been a tough go for tourism, such an important sector in the nation's capital. Let's bring in the Minister of Tourism for Ontario, of course, also Nepean MPP, Lisa McLeod. Good morning, Minister.
Good morning, Leslie.
You came with a check for the sector of tourism specifically here in Ottawa. What did you just announce?
Yeah, pretty big check for Ottawa tourism. We're a gateway city along with Toronto. We welcome international visitors, as you just mentioned. Ottawa Airport ramping up. I'm on my way there right now. And we want to make sure that when we are safely able to reopen for both leisure and business travel, that both the Shaw Centre and Ottawa Tourism are prepared and ready to go. And so we've announced $8.2 million today. $6 million going into product development, workplace development, and partnerships, among others, for Ottawa Tourism so that they can get their marketing plans and welcoming plans back up and running. And $2.2 million to the Shaw Centre to stabilize their operations so that when it's safe to actually have conventions again, and they'll be able to do that. So we really are not, we have been in planning mode for the past 16 months, and now we're able to inject that cash because we're going to start seeing those visitors back, and we're going to be ready for it.
Minister, is it time to open the U.S. border now? And the numbers are incredible right now, especially here in the city of Ottawa.
Yeah, look, I'm really proud to be an Ottawa resident. You know, yesterday, I think we had four cases. I was pretty ready to tell Dr. Kieran Moore, our new Chief Medical Officer of Health, how well we're doing. I'll leave the border issues up to the federal government. I'm more focused on the domestic issues and making sure that you know, we're able to travel across Ontario in a hyperlocal way at least this summer. And, of course, I'm hoping at some point we'll be able to start welcoming back in larger numbers people from different parts of Canada. But certainly our plan is to make sure that we incentivize people to travel across Ontario from Ontario. And that's why we'll kick in at the appropriate moment, $150 million travel incentive.
Yeah.
But we closely monitor what the feds are up to. And I know in many of our border cities, whether that's in, you know, Gananoque or Niagara Falls or Windsor, those mayors and those local tourism units are really having those, you know, conversations at a national level.
Okay, put your Minister of Sport hat on now here, because you're busy. You got several files under there. Let's switch files.
Yep.
Red Blacks, are they going to have? Are you ready to sign off yet? Has the new medical officer of health given you the go ahead for fans in the stands?
So we've accelerated their ability to play, so they can start basically at any time. And we're working right now with the Red Blacks, MLSC, and the Senators as well as others, on what a return to fans and stands looks like. I'm optimistic that we're going to see a certain capacity. What the Chief Medical Officer of Health actually signs off on in terms of what the capacity limits might be, that's still to be determined, but that work is ongoing. And in fact, you know, those are presentations that I'm making to my cabinet colleagues now in terms of what the sector feels is feasible, but at the same time, seeing what the Chief Medical Officer of Health is comfortable signing off on. But look, I am far more optimistic today, given the number of people with the double doses. The ICU capacity is way down, hospital visits are way down, and the case counts are way down. So, you know, I think there's a lot of hope in the air, and I'm certainly really excited. I'll be at a Red Blacks game. I miss them, and I can't wait for them to get back up and running.
Sounds like a formality. You're just waiting for sign-off. There's a piece of paper on his desk waiting to be signed.
Yeah, it is a very complex process we've been dealing with over the past 16 months.
Yeah.
You know, so we have a Jobs and Recovery Committee table that I sit at, and then there's a health table. And so we really do a lot of crosswalking, and especially when it comes to athletes, one of the things that we want to make sure is that if there were to be an outbreak, that we would limit the spread to athletes, because, you know, this is a respiratory illness, and we want to make sure that those athletes who make a living, that's their career,
sure,
don't have long-lasting impact. So it's one of the things we've been working on a long time. But we do have a new Chief Medical Officer of Health.
Yep.
He's from Eastern Ontario, from Kingston. He did a great job in Kingston and keeping that population safe early on in the pandemic. And so looking forward to working with him.
While we're talking Red Blacks, specifically TD Place, as you know, in the city of Ottawa, they've got the report coming out this week that basically says they got to tear down more stands. We're talking about a lot of money. Is there any provincial money in your Ministry of Sport to be able to beef up what TD Place, or are they on their own?
Well, I mean, I haven't had that conversation yet with Mark Gowdy. You know, there are pots of money, but it's mostly for minor sport. And there will be infrastructure money, obviously, that has come through the Ministry of Infrastructure. But also, we were working with the Ontario Trillium Foundation. So I haven't had the conversation with them yet. But certainly that what we're mostly focused on is the economic and social recovery of minor sports in Ontario.
Yeah.
Typically in safer times, we don't really have a line of sight into professional leagues. But given COVID-19, they certainly have been part of our recovery process.
Is it important to rebuild there?
Yeah, look, it's an iconic site. I went to my first political convention there when I supported Jean Charest back in 1993.
You're not that old, Minister. Come on.
I was 18 years old, and I was up from New Glasgow, Nova Scotia at that convention. And so, I mean, obviously, it's an iconic feature in the city of Ottawa, what they've done with Roger Greenberg and John Ruddy and others to rebuild that and revitalize the site has been nothing short of incredible. In fact, I often look at it as an inspiration for me as I look to the redevelopment of Ontario Place. So I think that it's a great spot. But, money is in tight supply right now, but happy to have the conversation with him because it's an iconic place in the city of Ottawa.
Final question: are the Blue Jays going to be able to play home on the 30th of July?
Well, my hope is yes. I've been able to clear them for a return to play. So the only issue right now is whether or not the federal government will allow them to go across the border and allow other teams to cross the border.
They did it for the NHL, right?
So my hope is that they adopt the model that they've allowed for the NHL. But again, we've cleared them to play, so it's all in the hands right now of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and his cabinet if they want them to play or not. Earlier on, we had cleared them to play in Ontario, and the feds said no, there would be no cross-border travel. But I think things have changed quite a bit, so my hope is the Blue Jays come home.
All right.
Minister, watch them play ball.
Minister of Sport, of course, tourism, as the announcement this morning, culture, heritage, working hard for the people of Nepean as well, MPP, Minister Lisa McLeod. Yes. Thank you for your time.
I'm excited. Thank
Appreciate
you very much.
It.
Take care.
You too.
Okay. Bye-bye.
10:59, we'll take a break. News Talk 580 CFRA.
This is Ottawa at Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580 CFRA. Share your opinion now. Text us at 580-580. Please include your name and where you're texting from.
Well, there's a new risk calculator out. It's helping predict how long seniors have left to live. Yeah, it's the Risk Evaluation for Support. Predictions for Elder Life in the Community tool. It's dubbed RESPECT for short. It can predict death within 6 months. It was developed using data from more than 500,000 community-dwelling adults, at least 50 years of age, who use home care, going back several years. Let's find out more about this, how it's being used. Dr. Amy Sue is with us, investigator at the Briere Research Institute and lead author of this study. Good morning. Good to talk to you. Thanks for your time.
Good morning. Hi, Leslie. Thanks for having me on the program.
Yeah, it's good to have you back. Okay, first and foremost, it's a little scary. In layman's terms, why was this necessary?
So RESPECT was developed for frail older people who might need additional supports and care in their homes as they approach the end of life. And as you mentioned, it's based on an algorithm that estimates their survival, which means how long they will live. And it uses a combination of 17 questions about their health and their ability to care for themselves. And one of the main motivations for developing this tool was because in our previous research, we found that very, very few Ontarians, so in fact, only 1 in 5 Ontarians actually receive a physician home visit in their home as they're approaching the end of life. And we know that actually quite a lot of Canadians, especially those living with terminal illnesses, want to spend their final days in a home environment or home life environment like a hospice. But without the support that they need, it would be very difficult to meet all the needs that they have as they decline their health.
So, again, in layman's terms, how does it work? Do you put in... answer these questions and then come to a conclusion based on those answers? And how accurate is it?
Yeah, so the instrument, the calculator, was really designed to inform care decisions that should be facilitated by a clinician or an individual's care team.
Okay.
So I think one of the reasons for developing this is because, a lot of times physicians are in a situation when they have to offer diagnoses and prognoses to patients. And the tool really, what it offers is more data that helps clinicians to make that decision. And so when we developed the tool, it was really with the vision of providing an instrument that will facilitate, that when they build a conversation between physicians and family members as well as patients. And in terms of accuracy, Leslie, there's several metrics that we can use to measure accuracy. One of the statistics, I know this is a little bit more technical, but one of the statistics that's used is called a C statistic.
Yeah.
And basically, it just tells you, what proportion of the people, if you were to randomly select two people, right, the risk for the person who end up experiencing the outcome, so the person who end up dying, should receive a higher risk score than someone who doesn't. And what we know is that, the average physician, in terms of their ability to prognosticate, their C statistic, their accuracy is around 60 to 65%. Whereas RESPECT, we're able to accurately identify the risk for people around 76% of the population.
So So the benefits outweigh the risks. And the risks, I know ethicists are saying, well, you know, if you do say they've only got 6 months left to live, there's a total shift in mindset for caregivers, family members, and then suddenly the poor senior in this particular case is felt like I'm being written off in 6 months. How do you stop that abuse potentially?
I completely agree with you. I think there's quite a few ethical concerns that we, continue to discuss as a research team as well in how the tool should be implemented. But, you know, I want to come back to my earlier point, Leslie, that a lot of Ontarians, so older adults in Ontario, do not receive palliative care at the end of life.
Got it.
And without this information, we're not able to identify who needs palliative care, who can benefit from additional support. So I think there has to be a balance in terms of how do we enable clinicians and care providers to assess an individual, a patient's care needs. But I think at the same time, you know, enable that conversation, right? So the tool is really designed to facilitate that conversation. So we can really set clear expectations about what they want in terms of their end-of-life care, what type of support they need.
It's about answering all the questions that people have as we get to that point in our lives.
Yes, definitely. I mean, it's meant to, I think, inform that discussion.
Yeah. Conversations that are important to have, especially when the time is limited, potentially. How is this being used now?
So the calculator is live on our research team's website. So I'm part of a larger research team based at the Brier Research Institute and the Ottawa Hospital Research Institute called Project Big Life. And our team actually specializes in developing these risk prognostication tools to inform care and care decision making. So a version of the calculator is live on the website, but we actually have several pilot programs in the community, also in long-term care. So working with our home care providers, for example, in a retirement home setting, where you have a large proportion of older adults who are frail and could benefit from more support. So working with care providers in those settings, but also in the community, to identify individuals who could benefit from that referral for a palliative care assessment and more home care support.
So palliative care assessment, how hard is it to get it in this day and age?
You know, the diagnosis, the prognosis has to come from a physician.
Okay.
Right? So when you're talking about, you know, the allocation of services from a home care perspective, often it's a complicated process. Because a patient has to be referred to their physician, who then makes a diagnosis, then they're referred back to home care to get the palliative care support. Or, you know, sometimes physicians make the home visits as well. And so we're really trying to simplify the abilities of different providers to communicate with each other. And the fact that RESPECT was built on home care data means that, you know, that assessment can be activated by home care case managers and care coordinators who first can identify that this is a frail patient who needs additional support, then send this information to the clinician, to their primary care physician, for example, to do further assessment. And then that actually allows an individual's care to be activated from multiple venues.
Is the end goal here to allow people to stay in their homes longer and then, I guess, not be moved out because of injury or something else, and then, you know, once, as we know, at that age, once you're frail and you're injured, there's sometimes it's tough to come back from that. Is this all about sort of allowing those who need the extra care at home the ability to do so that if they don't have, so that they don't, when they're no longer able, that they have the care they need to be moved when the decision is right?
Yeah, so the goal, I think, you know, is about high-quality end-of-life care.
Mm.
So some individuals may choose to die or wish to die in the comforts of their own home. And I've had many, many patients, I've had encounters with patients who have that ability to actually die in their own home with the support of great home care, with physicians who are making house calls, and they're surrounded by their family members and loved ones. You know, some individuals may choose to be transferred to the hospital setting. So the point of the goal of the calculator is really to enable individuals to achieve that high quality care wherever they wish, and allowing individuals to die with dignity, to die, you know, free of pain, free of suffering, and really be surrounded by their support system.
A pretty important tool in this day and age is the conversation, of course, is being had by more and more families. Dr. Sue, thank you. Appreciate the background. And as the lead author of the study and an investigator, Brier, thanks for all you're doing.
Thanks again for having me.
Cheers. It is 11:15. We'll take a break. News Talk 580. CF.
This is Ottawa at Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580 CFRA. Share your opinion now. Text us at 580-580. please include your name and where you're texting from.
We, of course, here in the city of Ottawa, very proud of the Kanata Tech Park for so many reasons. This could be another one, ladies and gentlemen. Driverless shuttles coming soon. This could be, it's being billed as, a transit solution for the park. We're talking like 25,000 employees potentially going from the LRT to work with something out of Disney. Let's find out more. Jamie Petten's with us, Executive Director and President of the Kanata North Business Association. Jamie, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me today.
Thank you. First and foremost, are you guys on board? Is this the way of the future now?
Absolutely. We're so excited about the results of the feasibility study that the association have led. And really the genesis for the project was twofold. The first was to evaluate transit and mobility solutions that, as you just mentioned, would carry our 25,000 Ottawa residents from across the city in and out of the tech park every day. And the second is an economic development opportunity. We're, wanting to take this opportunity to showcase the incredible technology that's homegrown here in Ottawa and from the technology park. And so why not pair those two things together? And that's really what we have here in terms of the results of the feasibility study.
Let's take the second one in a second, the economic development. Let's first talk about how it would work. Part of it would go on the 470 on the Queensway? How would that happen?
So we've evaluated two lines, a blue line and a green line. The first would be a more high capacity shuttle. It would be an electric autonomous bus that would connect from Moody Station through to the Technology Park across the Queensway and onto March Road. And the second would be more of an on-demand service coming off of Moody Station down Carling Avenue in mixed traffic, a low-speed shuttle that would take people in and out of the park at other off-peak times. We have business happening in and within the park as well as folks coming to the park. And so it was really important for us to evaluate an on-demand solution that would help to create mobility even within the park itself.
Why driverless? Why don't have a driver?
Well, I think that's the art of the possible that we're evaluating with this study. We do such innovative work, and by we, I mean our companies in the technology park, the 540 of them that, span from expertise in connected autonomous vehicles to Internet of Things to cybersecurity. And so, again, the connected autonomous vehicles component of this study was really to showcase the art of the possible in taking the technologies that are developed in Kanata North and deploying them on real live city streets.
Is there anywhere in other tech sector cities where something like this exists already?
Well, comparable cities would be, Silicon Valley and San Francisco, as well as, a number of major tech centers around the world. And so this intent is to elevate, the Kanata North Technology Park, but also the city of Ottawa's profile as a world-class, world-leading tech and innovation hub. And the more that we can start to integrate the technologies that we're developing here in Ottawa, the higher, that we raise the profile. And as a result, talent are then attracted to coming to live, work, play, and learn in our city, as are other world-class technology companies that want to be a part of this ecosystem.
How would it work? How does it manage traffic levels, know when to stop, when to turn? The fear of seeing, nobody in the front of the bus would be, at least you'd see I'm getting used to.
Yeah, and it will. And that's why, we've proposed through the feasibility study a phased approach to integrating these technologies and deploying them into live city streets. We're really excited at the potential of working with Invest Ottawa to pilot these shuttles within the technology park on low speed, low traffic streets within the next 12 to 18 months. And there are a lot of learnings that we can take from that before we get to the point where, 4, 5, 6 years from now, we do have, fully functioning shuttle services that are semi or fully autonomous.
Is there a prototype somewhere deep in a dark garage in Kanata at the tech ready and ready to rev up its engine?
We are ready to rev up our engines,
certainly.
But the Invest Ottawa team and the Kanata North Business Association have been collaborating for a few years now, and there have been some pilots of these shuttles that have already taken place. So we're taking some of those learnings, we're building upon those, And now, you know, the next natural step is to take these shuttles onto the streets and have our residents and our employees in the park start to be a part of this process.
Do OC Transpo operators have to get nervous that they may be replaced one day?
Well, we're hoping that OC Transpo, and you know, we've had a great relationship through the steering committee of this feasibility study, will actually, you know, be a part of the process with us in terms of taking these learnings and understanding, you know, how their service can work together with this one, and how their service providers can be a part of the process as well.
So, what's the next step? Are we ready to go? Are you waiting for a sign off somewhere?
Well, we've, you know, as you know, presented to the Transportation Committee of the City of Ottawa Council yesterday and received, you know, a great indication of support. The next step is to, you know, get our boots on the ground and start to raise some funds for that pilot study in collaboration with Invest Ottawa. And once we have those pilots running, we'll have learnings to take back and, you know, bring to other upper levels of government, the province and the feds, so that we can begin raising those, you know, larger dollars to get the shuttle services in full operation.
Is this a sample of some of the cutting edge projects you guys are in the process of doing?
It is. It is. We are, you know, it is a bit of a part of a bigger picture in that the Kanata North Business Association and the Tech Park have been evaluating with City of Ottawa's long-term planning teams what the future of the park looks like over the next, you know, 5, 10, 25 years. Very timely for us to do that inward looking as the official plan is starting to be renewed. And we're excited about many different opportunities to transform the Tech Park into a complete and connected community where we have, you know, a mixed use environment of live, work, play, and learn. Post-secondary institutions that have recently made investments in the Tech Park, increasing their presence and having students and researchers and our employees all collaborating in the future there.
Is there a specialty? Like, is what do the majority of the companies do? Is there like an AI division? What is it?
Well, our legacy, the Tech Park, you know, is over 50 years old now, and our legacy is in telecommunications. But as we've grown, you know, we've diversified in those subsectors. So 5G is an enormous opportunity for us in the Tech Park. But beyond that, software as a service, autonomous vehicles, AI, as you've mentioned, and cybersecurity as well. We're on the footsteps of the government here in Ottawa. So there's a lot of collaborative work that happens between our companies and the government in that regard. There's a ton of tech developed basically out of the Tech Park. And all in different, you know, real-world applications.
And I guess a lot of the employees come from abroad or come from away, as they say, on the East Coast.
Well, we have a good mix of, you know, local homegrown talent that have, you know, been a part of that legacy of the last 50 years in telecommunications. And then many talent that come either to study at our universities here in Ottawa and stay to work in the technology park or are recruited to work here at our multinational companies. That's the most amazing thing about the Kanata North Technology Park is that we have this diverse mix of technology companies that are very small startups all the way through to large multinationals. And as a result, they attract, you know, a really diverse set of talent.
When we talk tech, do we talk like video games even?
We do, yeah. We've recently had a really exciting exit in the technology park. UITV were recently sold, and they did a lot of that really fun work with applications like you might be familiar with Twitch and video game streaming applications. So, yep, there's a really diverse range of tech that are developed in the park.
Who bought them?
Time Warner.
Oh, somebody's retiring rich. The founders, I'm guessing. How long? I love these stories. How long in the making was UI from, you know, startup to the sale?
Over a decade. Wow. And, you know, I may not even be doing it justice. Your next interview should definitely be with Jason Flick, the CEO of UITV.
Okay.
Again, a homegrown Ottawa-based software company that have just done us all proud here in the city.
Hopefully he gets reception on his yacht in the Caribbean.
Or at least from his beautiful cottage here in Canada.
Good one, bringing it back home.
Yeah.
Jamie Petten, thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah, well, thank you for the opportunity.
Cheers.
And looking forward to sharing more of the results and progress as we continue on.
Absolutely. Keep us informed. I love this stuff. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Executive Director, President of the Canada North Business Association. All right, 11:45. We'll take a break. News Talk 580 CFRA.